trust yourself, right? Do whatever it is you need to do to trust yourself. If it means turning off all these negative voices that you hear from other people, do that. If it means not watching million-dollar homes because it's affecting your psyche, do that, right? Do what you need to do to gain the trust in yourself that you got this. Again, I'm back to the whole confidence thing. You've got to, and confidence is born in all sorts of different ways, right? Practice, practice, practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall, right? Practice, or take the R train and make a left on 57th Street. You got to practice. And I guess probably the final thing is don't be afraid of failure.
You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gondor.
And it's yet another good morning over here at Inside Launch Street. Hey, before we dig into today's podcast, which I'm, as always, excited to bring to you, a couple quick things. Number one is I want to share with you one of my favorite new apps that I've just totally gotten hooked on because it adds so much value to my world every day. It's called The Pattern. That's right. THEPATTERN, The Pattern. So you put in your birthday and the time that you were born, and it, I don't even know how, it's kind of magical. It throws back all these insights and information about you. Here's what I love about it. Every day I get a question or an insight about me, something that just makes me go, huh, I need to explore that, or I should think about how I'm approaching that in this world. There's a community behind it. So the question actually is answered by a bunch of other people. So you can see their answers and get inspired too. It's just this incredibly insightful app that's all about you. And as you all know, I love things that help me think differently, explore ideas, just give me a new perspective on myself and the world that I live in and how I can make an impact and add value to others. And this app absolutely does that. The Pattern. Go check it out. You will be shocked at how accurate it is. Shocked. All right, let's get on to today's interview with Henry Doss, who is a financial intelligence guru. Now, I know you're saying, wait, Tamara, this is a podcast about innovation and human potential and human performance. Why are we talking about finances? Well, I think I make the case through the interview. But let me just back up and tell you why right now so that you keep listening, because this is a powerful interview. Money and the way we think about money tends to control or cloud our emotions and how we go through the day. So if you don't have your money handled, whatever that looks like for you, I find that people who don't have that handled have this layer of stress or anxiety that actually clouds everything else that happens in their day. And those that have control and confidence in their money, well, I'm going to use that word again, they walk through the world with more confidence and more ease. And money's in a very, it's a very emotional thing for so many of us. And we dig into that in this podcast. But I wanted to talk to Henry because he's got a book called Financial Intelligence and FQ. And I think it's an important foundational element that we all need to get a handle of. He has a little bit of a different approach to it. This isn't just a like, how do I day trade versus how do I do a 401k? This is how do I think about and how do I manage and navigate this kind of money world so that we can do everything else we want. All right, with that, let's get to it. Hey everybody, Tamara here. I am super excited for today's podcast for a couple of reasons and for today's guest because I did some digging. I read his book. I went to the other podcasts he's been on and the blogs, and I learned so much. And as I was doing all this, I came to realize that one of the things that we don't talk enough about is money and financial intelligence and how it's such a mind game and a real game. And I think it really can push us forward or actually keep us from achieving our goals, no matter what they are, is that intelligence around it. And so, Henry, I'm excited to have you on. Actually, I'm going to have you introduce yourself, and then I want to share a little bit about why I wanted to have you on from a personal side and then dig into the questions. So, Henry, welcome. Tell us, if we don't already know you, although I'm sure most do, tell us a little bit about you.
Well, thanks for having me, first and foremost. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be anywhere when we're living through a pandemic, so not be covered with dirt. So, let's see. Brief backstory. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I started my first business literally 30 years ago, 1991, as an Apple reseller, a reseller of Apple computers. Again, this is, you know, way before the Apple stores and all that stuff. I've had a series of entrepreneurial businesses, some good, some bad, and one ignominious failure, as I like to describe it. That's how I call it, what I called it in my book. A few years ago, I wrote this book, FQ Financial Intelligence. I have a course around it, 20-week course, where I basically teach you everything in the book. I believe it's everything you need to know from your first savings bond to your last will and testament. And then I'm also an entrepreneurial coach. It's really like my main avocation is I coach entrepreneurs, $1 million to $10 million businesses. I coach them one-on-one via Zoom. I've always been virtual for the last 10 years, so the pandemic was no change for me. And that's it, in a nutshell.
Well, that's quite a lot, so I'm looking forward to digging in. So I want to just share something personal really quickly, because it goes into my first question. So when I got divorced almost 3 years ago now, I realized that I didn't know shit about finances, that I'd abdicated all of that in the marriage. And I got out of that and was like, oh my gosh, I need to figure this out. Like, how am I in my 40s running a successful business? And but I had no idea, like overall, I just had no financial intelligence. Like if I were really being fully transparent, I feel like I was starting at a place that I should have started in my 20s and didn't. So, I mean, it's so awkward to admit that. I think that's the first time I've ever admitted that, but
good for you.
And I went on this whole journey. Yeah. Thanks. Well, I went on this whole quest to figure it out. So I was like, I cannot let this slide. I shouldn't have let it slide to begin with, but now I have no choice. And really, I shouldn't. Everybody should understand this. So I guess my first question to you is why? Like, why are we so illiterate, or why do we avoid understanding money? Yeah. Why do we do that? Like, I know people who are wildly successful and quite brilliant, but in this area, they fall short. And I was one of those people.
There doesn't seem to be any correlation between intelligence and financial intelligence. You know, IQ, EQ, and FQ is what I call it. I thought I was very novel in coining that, although it's been the concept of FQ as financial intelligence has been around for a long time. I'll share a story from my family. You know, my parents were working class people. My dad was an engineer. My mom was a school teacher. So when my dad passed away in 2000, they had no idea. You know, they'd been squirreling money away and saving and investing in the stock market. They had no idea what their net worth was, what their contingent liabilities, obligations, anything. No clue. And we had to do the dreaded estate tax. So we literally had to figure it out in order to file that with the government. I spent a solid week with my mother. They had stock certificates in an unlocked filing cabinet in the basement, literally hundreds. They had dividend reinvestment with individual companies. So tiny statements with fractional shares of ExxonMobil and Abbott Labs and all this stuff. So fast forward a week later, I figured it all out so we could file the estate tax. I asked my mother, what do you think a net worth is? She gave me a number. I said, it's three times that.
Oh, and she had no idea. Nobody knew.
I'm going to cry thinking about it, because it's like, and just no idea. And she said,
but most of us
don't. She said, he left me a rich woman. That was my mother's response. Wow. 20 years later, it's crazy. And
thank you for sharing that. I have to say, because I think it really, let me just interject for a minute, because thank you.
I think it shows how personal money is and probably part of the reason why we work really hard to avoid it.
It is. It's an emotional topic. And my parents, they just never, I never knew. And it was a point of concern or fear growing up, you know, do we have money? Do we not have money? Is there a day going to come where we're going to end up destitute? I mean, some of it were cognitive distortions because we lived in a modest but nice home, and we had always had food on the table. But you don't know when you're a child. You have no idea. You just conjure up things in your mind. So the fact that my mom was in her 70s and that was the first time I actually had a strict accounting of what it is. I don't know. It was always a very hush-hush taboo topic. And the funny thing is, we're the opposite way, my wife and I. We've been married for 30 years and we're very transparent. I mean, we're not like down in the weeds with it, but we're pretty transparent about it. We want the kids to be confident that even when something like a pandemic comes around, if they ask, are we going to be okay? It's like, yeah, we're going to be okay. Do you want to see how okay we're going to be? It's okay, Dad. I'll take your word for it.
So let me ask you a question on this, because you talk about this in your book, FQ, Financial Intelligence. And money has a lot to do with mindset and psychology. Right. And I think both of our stories really, and what you were even saying with your kids really highlights that. And I've no doubt that the people listening to this are getting a little bit riled up, you know, thinking, oh, I got to deal with money, right? Because there's so much mindset. Can you talk a little bit about the psychology behind money? And specifically some of the things that work against us.
Well, I look at it like there are two goalposts, right? There's scarcity on one side and there's abundance on the other side. Ideally, you'd like to live somewhere in the middle. Usually people oscillate between them. So when there's something like the pandemic and the tide goes out, there's a natural tendency to circle the wagons and live in scarcity. Yet, when you look at the evidence of what's gone on in the pandemic, housing has gone crazy. So people are risk on. Yeah, let's go get a bigger house. Can't live like this. Just read a story about somebody living in Brooklyn in a 1,000-square-foot apartment. And they said, we can't live like this. And they moved to Colorado. And they were talking about the adjustment and the pros and cons and all of that stuff. I collect baseball cards. So usually, and only from like 1967 to 73 is kind of like my sweet spot, because that's when I did it as a kid. So usually every February, I'll go to a couple of shows. I'll go to one in Pennsylvania. I'll go to one in New York. Baseball cards sales has gone parabolic. It's insane. And I'm thinking to myself, this seems very odd, very disjointed to me. We've got rampant unemployment. We've got people who are really, really struggling. We have a Congress that's dithering around for months and months and months. And yet we got folks getting into bidding wars. We just bought a house. I had to pay 20% over the asking price. And the only reason I got the house is because I offered them all cash, right? Cash is king, which is what I talk about in my book. So there's all of these mixed signals. But getting back to the psychology of it, finding that balance between abundance, because remember, if you're lucky, you're going to get 80 years on this planet. You could live miserly, but then say to yourself, what am I giving up in order to do that? I'm not going to get a do-over. I'm not going to get another opportunity. But on the other side, there is a real reason for scarcity. If you're worried about your job, if you're worried about all of these different forces that are outside of your, forget about control, they're outside of your influence, then there's a natural tendency to say, I got to hunker down a little bit and be a little more careful than I might be otherwise.
I want to ask you a question about those two goalposts, because I think people vacillate day to day, if not situation to situation.
Minute by minute, you could say.
Yeah, well, especially in the last year, right? Because things have been, to your point, the signals have been so incredibly mixed. Like I play very minimally in the stock market, like I have my little play fund, and I've invested in companies that make boats and recreational outdoor, and they are crazy good, right? But other things are like tanking left, right, and center. So, right, because people are, well, we can't go to the movie theater, we can't do this, so we'll just get a boat and spend time on the lake. That's, you know, quarantining ourselves. So But the question I want to ask is, you know, if I'm out there and I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'd love to think like abundance, but hey, I've got rent coming up or my mortgage coming up and my job is on the line. So how do I psychologically get into a place where I can deal or manage with my money when, you know, everybody's out there going, you got to think abundance, you got to think abundance, but my box over here is falling apart on me. So how do you manage that in getting to a place of security and intelligence?
Well, the first chapter of my book is the psychology of money, but the first, what I divided it into three, what I call three acts. Cause one of the things that I do is I'm a screenwriter. I've written 11 screenplays. It's kind of like one of my little, I wouldn't call it a side hustle because it's generated exactly $0, but it's something that I do for fun. And I've entered into contests and I've had people read them. So the first act is really taking stock. So if I'm in that situation where I don't know, like my mother had no idea whether she was rich or poor or somewhere in between. So the first six chapters is really getting a sense of where am I? So you have to ask yourself a question. I'm worried, but am I worrying about the right thing? Am I really in trouble with my rent, right? Or do I have reserves? Do I have things that I can draw on that I'm not seeing? Is my job really at risk? My income stream. Is my income stream at risk? If so, how much risk is it at? Right? Is it a lot of risk or is it a little risk? When it's all said and done, if you find yourself waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning wondering about all these unanswered questions, that should be a sign that says, let's go get some answers because they're there. But now you got to get over the hurdle of, well, the reason I don't want to see the answers is because I have a feeling they're going to be really bad and I don't want to see that. So I'd rather just bury my head in the sand. That's not a prescription for success for anybody because eventually there'll be some inciting incident, to use the screenwriting terminology, that's going to force you to take that accounting. You don't want to do it at the point of a bayonet. You want to do it intelligently. That's why I sell a course, because when we go through those chapters, you got to do that work. Otherwise, we can't go on with the course. If I don't get to the end of chapter six and know your balance sheet and your income statement and your contingent liabilities, we got nowhere to go.
I'm so fascinated by what you're saying. Partially, I want to back up for a second because you said it kind of quickly, but I think it's important. You know, you were saying like, is the risk really what I think it is? And am I really worried about the right things? I think was the language mm-hmm. you used. And I do find, particularly right now, and I won't go on my soapbox about the media and how they're like shoving fear down our throats every day, but I do find that, yeah, but they are, right, exactly. But they do, which is why I stopped watching. But I do find that it's very easy to spin and to stay in a place of like, oh my God, I'm concerned about money for whatever reason. And to your point, it may not be something you really need to worry about, or maybe you're just worried about the wrong parts of it, or who knows. So you talked about taking stock. Is that the first step for getting out of that place of, I would say, lacking in intelligence or unknown, and getting to a place where you can move forward? And if so, like how do you really think about doing that? I mean, if you're just an everyday person, you're like, all right, I got to look at all my debts, all my savings, all my, right? I'm trying to get kind of really in the weeds a little bit because I do think, yeah, well, and I do think that particularly when it comes to money, if you stay up here, to your point, you never actually move forward. It's really just a conversation right in your head. So you kind of have to get, I mean, it's numbers. So it's not like there's nothing fuzzy about it. It either is or it isn't.
It's not that hard to do. I mean, I sort of went through it in the book that says, okay, look at what your assets are. You know, you own a house. Your house is worth $300,000. Good. What's the note on the house, right? When the note is $200,000, great. You have $100,000 worth of equity, right? And that'll go on the asset side. What do you have for liabilities? Well, I have a bunch of credit card debt. I have this, I have that. One of the things I talked about is that a huge swath of our society, millions, if not tens of millions, will get to be 30 years old, college educated, smart, employed people. They'll get to be 30 and they'll have a net worth of zero. My wife and I were one of them. When we got married, I was 31, she was 29. And we had $30,000 in my 401k and $30,000 in credit card debt. So basically, we had a net worth of zero. We're 30 years old. We've lived 3/8 of our 80 years, right? Pretty amazing. It's a little sobering. Time to start getting your act together. Getting over the hump to just sit down, even if it's just a pad and pencil, which is why I sell a course, because basically I make you do it. That's it.
Yeah. So we'll put a link to the course in the show notes. I just want to make sure to say that so the listeners aren't over there trying to Google and listen at the same time. Yeah. We'll definitely do that. I'm part of the reason why I wanted to have this conversation, aside from my own personal journey and understanding the importance of knowing your money, is I think that when I look at people who have financial intelligence, they also have a sense of ease about them that people who don't do not. And I think part of that is because you know, right? You know what's going on. You know how it all works. You know what you are worth or not. You know what you need to do to change things or not. So will you talk a little bit about that kind of shift that you see? I'd love to hear like some of the people in your course, if you can share an example without giving away details, obviously, of that transition or how it helped them get to the next level. Because I saw it for myself and I've seen it in other people where when you understand your money, things open up for you in a big way. And it's something that people don't, I don't know that we realize that's possible just by understanding your money, but it is.
Well, it's even more generic than that. Like I coach, I have three boys. I've coached probably 40 teams, little leaguers, football, lacrosse, you know, you name it. And I remember telling them, look, there's only one thing that you need in order to be successful in almost any avenue of life. And that's confidence, right? So yeah. When you go through the process and go through the course, the sort of the overarching message is I want to give you confidence. Now you're confident with your money as opposed to being worried about it. So here's an example. I don't want to name any names, but this was somebody who was actually one of my beta testers when I first did the course. And she'd lost her husband a few years prior. He died of cancer. And some financial person got their hooks in her and convinced her to take all of her money and put it in an annuity. Mm. And she, after we started the course, she said, I cried myself to sleep at night after we were going through the course, realizing, you know, what a colossal blunder she had made. So I had to talk her down off the ledge there to say, look, you made the best decision you could make with the information you had at the time. So there's no reason to cry about that, right? I'm not going to go back and say, yeah, I made a bad decision. If that's the data that I had, that was a decision I made, I stand by it. It was more about if I had just learned myself up on this stuff before I went and made a decision like that, because I don't say good things about annuities at all. I know they may have a place in some people's lives, but having some direct experience as an executor for someone who shall remain unnamed estate, who had also put all of their money in annuities, it's a huge moneymaker for the one who's selling you the annuity. It's the false sense of security in every means. And this is how people get taken advantage of, right? Which is another part of the whole exercise of gaining financial intelligence. Think of it as like financial armor, right? Which is a term I'm just making up right now as we speak. It is. It's armor against, you know, chapter 15, I believe, is I call it gypsies, tramps, and thieves. It's, you know, it's like all the people that are out there. You know, it's the old Cher song.
Yeah, I loved that chapter and I love the name even more. But one of the things I've started to see, I just want to just when you talk about that chapter is, so I don't post on TikTok, but I will spend more time than I should perusing through the videos because it's amazing how 30 seconds can turn into 30 minutes before you know it. But I know they're brilliant at that. But I'm amazed at how many I'm seeing that are stock market suggestions too. And what I'm finding that's super interesting about them is they're posting after the fact. Yeah. So let's say a stock shot, right? And they're posting at 4 p.m. So they didn't have any insight, but they made it sound like they suggested that stock and then it went up, right? Or whatever. But I'm fascinated by all the channels that are now out there for people to promote themselves. I think every industry has this problem, frankly, but all the channels that are out there for people to promote themselves as financial experts who don't know jack about anything, but they have the channels to do it and there's no proof that they aren't. You know what I mean? It's hard to prove the negative.
No, I'm with you 100%. I belong to a group that's like real professional stock traders, because that's really my wheelhouse is trading stocks. I do it every day. I've been doing it basically every day for 40 years. We call it the right edge, right? They're talking about everything that's left of the right edge. Well, the right edge of the chart is the future. We don't know that. We're trying to intuit what that is. So they're wonderful Monday morning quarterbacks. They will never admit when they put on a trade and it went south. I aired a lot of dirty laundry in my book because I'm a human and I think people can learn from it.
That's how you learn. And honestly, the ones who are right all the time are not.
No one is. Even Warren Buffett will come out and tell you that his company, but I wrote about in the book, Berkshire Hathaway, is named after probably his worst trade ever. It was a company that he bought and never could turn it around. I guess maybe he hung on to the moniker just to remind him of, you know, one truly bad trade. You're going to get your lunch taken away from you. These guys who are doing the pump and dump, or these Reddit types who are doing AMC and this and that, trying to exploit little cracks and bidding up GameStop to $500, what's basically a $2 stock on paper. Stay away from all that. I mean, I tell people, turn it off. Turn off MSNBC or CNBC, Bloomberg, all of those things. Find a few trusted sites, ones that will give you as unbiased as information as is possible, and follow your instruments and follow your own training. You need somebody to train you, and you're going to make mistakes and you're going to lose money. But you only got to be right one more time than you're wrong, and you'll make money.
So it's interesting because I think in the financial world in particular, there's a big difference between fact and opinion, but a lot of opinions are stated as facts. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I think it gets really messy. So, but the question I want to ask you, you mentioned your book, and I want to ask you a question about, you have a whole section, you said an act, right? You call them acts, called Money Stuff You Simply Must Know. And I really like that section because I like things that are very like, let me be specific and here's like the things you need to know. So I'm curious, after, you know, you've had so many people in your courses, readers, et cetera, what are their favorite parts out of that section or the whole book, really? I'm just curious, like, what are those insights or tips that rose to the top that we can give our podcast listeners to get them started?
Well, the number one thematic element is the concept of risk. Henry, I didn't realize that this was so risky, right? Whatever it might be. We all have different risk tolerances, right? I've been trading stocks for years and years and years. So my risk tolerance is significantly greater than someone who's just a newbie, because they don't want to lose principal, right? They'll buy a stock, they'll go long on a stock, and it'll immediately tank. And what'll they do? They'll double down on it. I'm gonna prove that I wasn't wrong when I bought this stock, right? So what I have to teach them is, when you're wrong, admit it quickly, and get out, right? I mean, at the beginning of the pandemic, I'll share this because I was holding 3M stock, right? I've owned 3M stock on and off over the years. I have a tendency to trade the same stocks over and over. I have a previous stocks list. I think there's 100 stocks on there that I've bought maybe in my lifetime, right? Considering there's like 10,000, hundreds a tiny number. And I've made money off 3M, but it was a dog. It just was not performing. And then all of a sudden it's N95 masks and the this and the that. And I'm like, okay, they should see an uptick. Well, guess what? They didn't. And then I went and I looked at the fundamentals and I just asked myself a simple question. Well, if in this environment, this company can't make a profit, maybe they ain't never going to make a profit. At least this go round. And I dumped it. And I took probably a $15,000 loss on it, right? Not an insignificant amount of money. Sometimes you got to cut your losses. That's it. Just got to get out and find something that's better, right?
I want to go back and dig into though what you said about risk. So one is risk tolerance, of sure, right? And how much room you have to lose. But I'm curious if you have any exercises to help any of us understand risk at the basic level, not just stocks, because that's like that's over here a little bit. But like, I want to open up a, I want to get a new credit card. I want to get a line of credit for my business. I want to take a second, you know, mortgage out of my house so that I can redo the kitchen. Like all of those decisions, I think, big and small for business and personal, have risk attached to them that we either don't understand, either overestimate or underestimate. So how do you help people think through that? Because I think there are some decisions I've made over my life that had I really actually understood the risk, I either would have taken them and others I would not have taken.
No, it's a great question. So we'll use housing as an example. So most lenders will require 20% down. You know, I just closed on a mortgage on this house. Anything less than 20%, you have to pay mortgage insurance, right? So, but my philosophy is I want to be 50-50 partners with the bank. So that's how I structure it. I feel better when my head hits the pillow, even though I'm probably leaving some money on the table because there's cheap money out there to be had, right? My mortgage closed at 3% and my wife is like, why was it so high? It's like, okay, it wasn't so high. It was fine.
Yeah.
Because during the first mortgage that we did together 28 years ago was 7 3/4. And we felt like we died and went to heaven, right? Because we're old enough to remember the 1970s when the mortgage rates were 20%. If you're a millennial, you have no context to that. You've lived your entire life in a unnaturally low interest rate environment, right? So for me, being 50-50 partners is fine. Right? That's the kind of balance that I want to achieve. So you have to ask yourself the same thing. Well, what's going to make me happy? Right? Do I want to be a riverboat gambler and just say, you know what? I'm going to do what they did back in 2007 to 2008. I'm going to get 105% of the equity of the place and just take a note for everything. Well, what's my risk? Right. Well, actually, you have no risk, right? Because if you're that leveraged and you go underwater, you just walk away because you had no money in play. Think about how you're going to feel if this all blows up, right? Whatever the deal you might be doing, whether it be, you know, buying GameStop, you know, going long on it, right? I put $10,000 and I think I'm going to make a quick profit, but it all goes in the dumpster. How am I going to feel? I know people that bad beat, that single bad beat, and they won't go back into the market at all. I know people, successful people, who said I got burned so bad that I never want to take that chance again. That's foolish. You're leaving money on the table. You made a mistake. That's okay. Why don't we go back and see what you did wrong? Do an analysis. Do a post-mortem.
This may sound super basic, but as you're talking, it makes me think of how I approach a night out gambling. So I take my cash, and my cash is what I have. And I decide on that cash based on how good I'm feeling about everything. But also it's like, if I lose all of this money, it makes no difference.
Yeah.
I can still pay my hotel bill. I can still go to dinner. I'm still flying home. My mortgage is still getting paid. My business is still running. Like that is truly how I think about my going out in Vegas or something like that. So I may take a little less than somebody else, but that's the money that if my risk, my worst case scenario came true and I lost everything, right? Then I'd be like, man, that was a fun night out, whatever. And I'm not saying you can always be that comfortable with your risk. Some things are a little bit more of a leap, but I like what you're saying about like, you really got to think about what's going to make you happy, but also what's the end goal you're going for? And what are you comfortable with happening if the worst case or the best case scenario happens?
Well, you know, I've been to Vegas many, many times, like probably at least 20 times. I got married in Las Vegas on New Year's Eve in 1991. So I'm very familiar with it. Most of the time when I go, I don't even gamble anymore. But when I do, I go to the craps table, which is the only game I play. I bring $500. Yeah.
I play craps.
My dad played craps. He taught me it's very mathematical. What you do doesn't affect anybody else. All those things. Right. $500 is my stake. If I lose it, I'm done. I don't go to the ATM. I've only lost it once in my entire life have I ever, but I played for a couple of hours and you know what? I said, okay, I did it. And I went on my way. But I've won $500 playing craps as well. You know, it all kind of evens out in the wash. The important thing was I set a parameter for what I was going to lose. It's the same thing when you trade stocks. You don't look at how much you're going to invest to trade the stock. You look at how much am I willing to lose on this particular trade? And I set my stop losses accordingly. And if it hits that, I'm automatically out. Those are the metrics that you need to, not how much capital is required, because there's a lot of ways to work around capital requirements. What's your downside risk? And if you can live with it, then you do it.
So I want to ladder it up for a second, because what you're talking about makes me think about kind of emotions and money. And so my dad is big in the stock market. He's been giving me lessons for the last year, and then I go do stuff and then I run and buy him. Right. So it's been a great bonding experience, but also it's been really great for my financial intelligence. And, but one of the things he was talking about is with stocks in particular, don't get emotional, like find your systems at work and don't make decisions based on emotion. So anyway, a lot of stuff in that, but I'm curious overall high level, not just stocks, but I mean like your financial intelligence overall, where does emotion fit in that equation for you?
One of the things that I say, in my book is that you should never trade you should never make any important decision when you're in a heightened emotional state. Every day I do a little mini psychological profile that was taught to me by a gentleman named Dr. Alex Elder, who's written a dozen books and is a master trader. And he was one of my trading mentors and actually a personal friend. And he grew up in Estonia, and he's a psychologist, actually a psychiatrist by training. Fascinating story. And he came to America with $20 in his pocket. And so he shared with me these five questions that he asks every morning, and you get an answer back. It's either a green light, trade away, an amber light, trade with caution, or a red light, no trade. And if it's a red light and there's no trade, I don't trade. Even if a trade lands on my lap and screams at me and says, trade me, trade me, trade me, I don't. I respect the signals. I tell people you should never trade unless you are just in a total, flat, emotionless state. You should never really make any kind of decision when you're triggered, but certainly not money-related decisions. Trading should be, if you're doing it right, it should be fabulously boring. You want to make boring money. If your trading is exciting, you are doing something wrong. And that would hold for trading or anything. This is not where I want to get in excitement in my life. I want to make as easy a money as I can make it.
Well, I think we get emotionally attached to things too, don't you think? Like, so I got suckered into $1 million real estate, New York. So, because I read Ryan Serhant, it's a TV show with it. Ryan Serhant, I never say his name right. He just wrote a book called Big Money Energy. And
okay.
I've been trying to get
it. TV show where they flip $1 million plus.
TV show. It's all like $1 million homes in New York. Just that's all you need to know. But what I found fascinating about it isn't the buying and the selling of the real estate. It is how emotionally attached people get to the number that they place on their house. So, well, I put in all this fancy stuff, so the house should be worth $5 million, not $4 million, even though nobody else cares about the fancy stuff. You cared about that special marble from Estonia, right? Nobody cared. But there's always these arguments that happen of people trying to inflate value or deflate value based on an attachment to something that really has no place in the equation of what something is or isn't worth. And I guess I'm not even sure what my question is there. I just wanted to throw that out to you because I think it's fascinating to see how it all connects for people.
We bought a house in Westchester almost 20 years ago, and $1 million plus house when we were living in Manhattan and the kids were growing up, three boys, and they needed more space. And
New York City. It's
and I'm reading the contract and I read the whole contract. And then you get to the rider.
Yeah.
And the rider's like five pages long. and everything's, you know, normal in the rider. Very last line of the rider says, we want a 5-year moratorium on the demolition of the house. So I went to my attorney and I said, what is this? And then he went back to the other attorney, and it was an estate sale. And the woman said, the daughter of the man who had actually built the house, he built it as a gift for my mother in 1952. I don't want a builder buying it and knocking it down. And I thought to myself,
then don't sell it.
What business is this of yours? What I do with this house when I buy it? I said, that has a value, because if I decide I don't want to live there and I want to then sell it to a builder, I can't because of this covenant. Oh yeah, it took us a month to negotiate that. So yeah, you talk about being sentimentally attached. This is someone who was trying to put a collar on what someone else could do with a property that you don't even own
it. After they buy
it. It gets a little bit crazy. And it's tough. We've looked at zillions of houses. We were just house hunting. We bought this house in Connecticut. And I have to remind my wife all the time, do not fall in love with the house. She'll fall in love. We had it happen about 5 years ago to buy a house up in upstate New York. And we had a contract and everything. And then the seller, flaked out. I said, don't fall in love with it, because there's always going to be another one. If you don't get it, there's another one.
Right. Well, and I've been through house hunting multiple times now.
You know what it's like.
Emotional. Yeah. Painful. And it's hard not to fall in love, because, and then you don't get it and you think the world is over, and then you make concessions you shouldn't make.
You do stupid stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's two, there's a lot of things I've taken out of this interview so far, but the two big ones that really, I just kind of summarize the conversation. One is, know what you're really, I'm going to say three, and then I'd love for you to add the fourth, okay, the final one. So one is, make sure that you're a relationship with reality, meaning know if you're worrying about the right things, mm-hmm, or like have the right questions. The second one is, know your risk and your risk tolerance and how that really works for you. And the third, I think, really big one in all of this is, don't make decisions and don't get emotional about it, right? Be a little bit more objective in how you approach all of your money, really. What's a great fourth one to end our interview on, or get close to ending?
I would say, trust yourself, right? Do whatever it is you need to do to trust yourself. If it means turning off all these negative voices that you hear from other people, do that. If it means not watching million-dollar homes because it's affecting your psyche, do that, right? Do what you need to do to gain the trust in yourself that you got this. Again, I'm back to the whole confidence thing. You've got to, and confidence is born in all sorts of different ways, right? Practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall, right? Practice, or take the R train and make a left on 57th Street. You got to practice. And I guess probably the final thing is, don't be afraid of failure. Right. I say that it takes a kilo of pleasure to equal a gram of pain. Right. Mm-hmm. I like the metric system. There are failures awaiting you. Right. You can't, if you're going to run away from every single one of them, you are going to live in total scarcity. Right. You just will. I mean, you'll be agoraphobic. Why even go out? Right. It's there. I'm not telling you necessarily to lean into failure. I talked about the scene in Fight Club where he says in the book where he says, go out and pick a fight with somebody and lose on purpose. I'm not talking about that. I'm not saying like purposely tank a trade. Trades are going to fail on their own. It's okay. You're human. It's going to happen. Forget these guys on TV who are so perfect and have never had a bad deal go sideways or whatever. There are people out there trading on the fact that they predicted the 87, you know, stock market crash. What have you done for me lately? They are entertainers, pure and simple. They are, in fact, they're actually prohibited, thanks to Dan Dorfman, they are prohibited from even materially participating. A guy like Jim Cramer is not allowed to trade stocks, right? He's got some kind of charitable trust thing, right? So they don't even have any skin in the game.
Right. And why would you listen to someone else? I feel that way across most things. Why would you listen to someone who hasn't done it and has no skin in the game?
They've completely de-risked themselves, which is great. That's wonderful, right? And they're getting paid millions of dollars to be on TV and talk about stuff and all this nonsense, but they have zero risk, right? They've just transferred it all to you. You've now assumed it all. Don't do that.
Welcome. So I have to say, I think our kind of feelings on failure are pretty aligned. Failure is less about if it happens or not. I think it's more about expectation than it is about outcome. And what I mean by that is, I think you need to expect failures to happen. And if you expect it, you're not derailed by it. You learn from it, you grow. I mean, I'm not a fan of people who say failure doesn't exist. It's all just learning. I agree it's all learning, but it does feel like failure. And I think it's dismissive to tell someone like, you'll never have a failure. I think we have them, but I think it's a matter of expectation. Yeah. And I know I'm going to fail a ton. So if I know that when it happens, I don't feel knocked on my ass because I knew at some point I'm going to do my best not to, but I know at some point it's not going to work the way I wanted it to.
It's resiliency. You know, I'm a golfer, and if I thought about every bad shot, and I've had it happen out there where I've been out and around and I hit a bad shot and it stuck with me for like two holes, and I played those two holes really, really badly because I'm still thinking about the shot that I screwed up two holes ago. You got to shake that off, right? You just got to, okay, great. I got to keep moving on. I got to use the tools that I have because I know that I can do this. Right. Especially you look at it at 61 years old. I've been successful for too long to think that even a series of setbacks is some kind of permanent change. It's just not. It's just it's like a cold streak at the craps table. Right. The dice are going to turn around. The problem is, can I stay solvent enough? Can I manage my $500 long enough for the dice to turn around? I don't know.
I'm actually glad you said that because I didn't get a chance to ask the question, but one of the things I jotted down that I wanted to just talk to you about was, and we've kind of covered it in kind of everything we've talked about, but part of the reason I wanted to have a conversation about financial intelligence, even though my podcast is Innovation and Human Performance, is I don't think, to your point, you got to stay in the game. And if you can't keep yourself afloat, you can't do the things you want to do. You can't make an impact. You can't support your family. You can't start that business. You can't get to the next level because all of that muck from the financial uneasiness that you have or lack of money that's about to pull you down is going to get in the way of all of that. So to me, financial is a foundational element that has to be there for all those other things to happen.
And the thing is, it's not really taught anywhere. I teach it in my course. I'm an electrical engineer. I have a degree in electrical engineering, and I probably took 5 years of calculus, right? But nobody ever taught me how to balance a checkbook. I had to learn that on my own. Nobody taught me how to read a stock chart or a company's 8K report. I had to learn that on my own, right? All of these building block fundamental bits of financial knowledge, you're not going to get that in school. They're trying to change that with financial literacy programs and things like that. It's not doing a particularly good job of it. That's a story for a separate podcast, and it's only because you got to make it entertaining. Like I have a white paper that I built for a fantasy football league that's based on the stock market. So it teaches market theory, but it's fun, and it's something that people can relate to because it's kind of like players as stocks. There's a big trend, I think, in the gamification of learning. And I think it's really, really important. If you can turn these things into more game theory, it's more relatable, because otherwise it's boring. I mean, reading Disney's quarterly report is pretty dull.
So this is going to date myself a little bit, but I remember in the beginning of high school, right before they canceled it, I took some kind of home ec class that wasn't cooking, but it was budgeting and doing laundry. Sure. And it was like life skills, but then it went away.
My boys did that. Yeah. I thought it was great.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good. Yeah. I don't think either. I have a 12-year-old and a 16-year-old, both boys, and I've never seen, not in school anyway. I make them do all of it at home,
right,
whether they like it or not. But it's a shame we don't teach more of it, because so many, and especially you get to college and then the credit cards come calling and you're like, free money, but it's not free money.
My middle son is a real spendthrift, and he has my credit card because he was doing all the Costco shopping during the lockdown and stuff like that. I stayed hunkered down. But every so often, when I get the bill, I got to read in the Riot Act. And it's like, he's living, we have an apartment in New York City and he's living in New York City. And it's like $40 for an Uber. It's called a subway. You're 24 years old. Sure.
Take the subway.
It's called a subway, right? Just swipe that little card and stop. It's great when it's other people's money. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Funny. Well,
it's like, other kids, they'll learn.
They'll learn over time, but there have to be consequences for when they do it. Otherwise,
they just have to be reminded every once in a while. So,
yeah. All right. So, where can people go to get the book, check out the course, connect with you?
So, my main website is DAAS Knowledge, which is actually showing up in this little video here at the top, DAASKnowledge.com. And if you want to download, you can download the book for free if you go on the FQ tab. It is available on Amazon if you want to pay $20 for it, but if you want it for free, just go and download it.
Well, I feel like that's a test right there of your financial intelligence.
Well, you know what? The only one who makes money off of books is Jeff Bezos. It's just a simple reality. Well, if you want to get rich, don't be an author, right? It's like, it's not where, when I consider all the effort and expense, thousands of dollars for a copy editor and this, that, and the other thing, it's kind of a sinking fund. Maybe it's more of a vanity project. But it is available there. If you want to take the course, you can, you can sign up for a strategy session. Talk to me about whether you're a fit or not. Happy to talk to people about it. That's it.
Well, this has been great, Henry. Thank you. And I want to remind the listeners, especially I'm so proud of ours tend to listen all the way through, which makes me so happy because that's not often the case. Just as a reminder that I have no doubt in the very beginning, you're going, wait, tomorrow's about innovation and human performance. Where does financial intelligence fit in? And I hope that over the course of the last 45-ish minutes that we have made the case for why it matters so much. And I know that there are some of you out there who probably have your financial house not in order. I know what that feels like. So I would never judge someone for being in that place. I would just encourage you to do exactly what Henry said, which is take stock and then go get the book and go sign up for his course, because I know firsthand the difference it makes when you get a hold of that and when you start to really have control of it. It doesn't change overnight, but you can't change it at all if you don't control it. So, Henry, thank you so much for joining me. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure was mine.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.